Hello and welcome back. This is Victoria Aduda from Zenith Lifestyle, bringing you the podcast featuring multidimensional people. Here we will talk to people who have visited and taken glimpses of worlds beyond the physical, and who have also found a way to live in both worlds simultaneously, creatively, successfully. Those are our multidimensional people. So today we have Maggie Latourell here. And Maggie, welcome. I've read your book, which I found was a fascinating and really, really important source for an extraordinary experience that you had with your mother. And for those listeners who have not read your book, I just want to say that it's about your mother who was suffering at the end of her life under the dreaded illness of Alzheimer's. And you were scared as well, naturally, when it all started. But then, despite all the difficulties, you found that there was something valuable and something that you ended up calling as the gift of Alzheimer's. So, Maggie, could you tell me a little bit more about the background of this experience and the background of the book, how you ended up writing it? So what was it that made this dreadful illness into a gift?
Well, first I want to thank you, Victoria, for inviting me.
Well, thank you for being here.
For something that is very close to my heart. Yes, my mother was diagnosed with Alzheimer's at the age of 85.
Yes.
And I was living in London and my parents were living in Scotland. So to begin with, I was managing quite a lot of the arrangements from a distance and visiting my parents for about 1 week in four. That became more frequent as my mother's condition, you know, physical condition deteriorated.
Yes.
Although my book is called The Gift of Alzheimer's, I just want to say that on this earth, it was not a gift. She suffered.
Yes, yes.
Just like everyone else who has this disease, although it takes different paths with different people, she went through all the normal stages of suffering at the beginning, and it was an absolute nightmare for us as a family.
Yes.
It got to the point where she was a danger to herself and those around her. She was falling, getting up at night, falling, injuring herself, turning on the gas hob and not lighting it, and yes, so on and so forth. So within 2 years of having been diagnosed, she went into a residential care home. And the care home happened to be right next door to our family house. So although it was devastating, and I can remember sitting on the edge of her bed just weeping as I thought, she's never coming back to her beloved home. On the other hand, it was almost as if she was living in an extension to our house where she was being properly cared for and safe. And the staff, it was an independent care home, the staff were very loving. And she, having been very belligerent and difficult, became very compliant and very happy. It was as if she surrendered to her situation. And I just want to say that 2 years seems a very short period of time, but it's quite possible that she had this disease for some time before.
Yes.
We didn't recognize that because she was quite a difficult person. And if I just give you a little background to her life, she had an extremely difficult and traumatic life. She suffered from postnatal depression after I was born. And I don't think it ever left. She spent her life talking about having one nervous breakdown after another. She suffered from chronic depression. This led to, you know, to attempts or threatened attempts on her life. And as a child, I was witness to that. And that set up quite a difficult relationship between us. So that was, you know, where we were starting from. When she was a resident in the care home.
Yes, I got it from your book that she must have felt very restrictive in that social order.
Absolutely.
She was in, wasn't she? That she sounded like a very energized person. She was a dancer, wasn't she? And a
She was. She
physical
was.
education teacher. And she seemed very outgoing and wanted to probably have a career which she couldn't have in that old-fashioned world.
That's absolutely correct. This
Yes.
is provincial Scotland, and my father was very conservative, and my mother was a kind of Isadora Duncan type.
Yes.
And it wasn't just my father, the whole society. You know, if you were a middle class professional family, you know, the wife didn't go out to work. She stayed at home, and my mother found this intolerable. And of course, it didn't help her mental state,
No.
nor her relationship with
We are
my
talking
father.
about a really frustrated life, don't we?
Yes,
Yes,
yes.
yes. But
So,
that changed. So what happened in those years?
well, it changed when she got Alzheimer's. It changed when she got into the care home. And I think there were some factors that contributed to this. Seeing her in this very frail, diminished state, I felt compassion for her. And it's hard to imagine how anyone close to, you know, a family member couldn't look at them when they have Alzheimer's at this stage and not feel compassion. You know, she was frail, she was losing the place, she got confused, she was repeating herself. Anyway, my feelings of compassion led to feelings of love. And she said to me one day, she said, "You love me." And I thought, is this a question or is it? It wasn't clear, but I reassured her that I loved her, and I really did. And then immediately after that, she said, "I'm a bad person." And I thought, oh dear, I think I know where this might be coming from, you know, given her history. I might even have prompted this by being present with her, reminded her. And it makes me think of what Carl Jung said. Jung said that forgotten or repressed material surfaces in a state of diminished consciousness. And I think that, you know, this happens. Well, it certainly happened with my mother, and I think it probably happens with people generally when they have Alzheimer's. And if people recognize that this is what's happening, it might explain some of the what's considered to be bizarre behavior. And things, you know, with that people say who have Alzheimer's.
Yes.
I also discovered after my mother passed on, I was curious to find out more about some of the things that I had felt intuitively and had, you know, discovered through my own experience. And one of them was to do with emotions and memory. And I found some research by Professor Oliver Turnbull at Bangor University, UK. He did research into Alzheimer's and memory, and he found that although short-term memory disappears as brain cells, you know, die off, and people are repeating themselves and can't remember what they've just said, emotional memory remains intact. And not only that, people with Alzheimer's can continue to learn emotionally. And this happens with my mother without
Absolutely.
any doubt. And I think it's really important for people to be aware. It's very easy if you see somebody in a very diminished state and confused, etc., to think that nothing's going on. But actually, a lot is going on. I also discovered in my quest for, you know, more information, I discovered research that was carried out at the University of California Memory and Aging Center. They found that people with Alzheimer's, as cognition decreases, empathy increases. So again, you know, although people may not be able to converse and express themselves with the clarity that they once did, that doesn't mean that they're not sensing and taking in what's happening. It means that they're They are very sensitive to nuances of expression, of our voice tone, of our facial expressions, probably more so than the actual words that we use. I also, these same researchers also found that when people are empathizing in this way, that the more cognition decreases, the more empathetic they become. So I think this opens a whole new vista to our understanding of people with Alzheimer's.
It does. It does. And
they found that not only are they feeling empathetic, but they do something with that. Mm-hmm. They mimic what they're sensing from us, and then they feed that back to us. And the term they use is emotional contagion.
Mm.
So if, you know, when I was feeling loving and generous in spirit towards my mother, she sensed that, even if I wasn't saying anything. And she fed it back to me. She said at one point, "I see love coming from your eyes."
Yes.
And she said another time something like, "Love is flowing between us."
Yes. I found that quite touching when I read in the book that she said, "You're the only one who's listening to me."
She did. And I'm glad that you reminded me.
Yes.
Because she said that just a few weeks before she passed on.
Mm.
She said, "You listen to me. Mm. Nobody else listens to me."
Mm. Mm. And it's quite obvious that other people did physically listen to her as well.
Yes.
But what she must have referred to is that you had that ability to tune in into that nonverbal, non-cognitive, more emotional, more psychic, more empathic type of communication, which she became every day stronger and stronger at.
Yes. And also, I, and this is something that's useful, I think, for people to pay attention to.
Mm-hmm.
When you're with someone with Alzheimer's, you need to almost sort of park your life and your way of being somewhere and move into their world with them.
Mm.
Start to explore, be curious about the meaning of their world. And that's what I did. So when my mother said at the near the beginning of this journey together, she said, "It's difficult." She said it's difficult living. And then she corrected herself and said, "Working between two worlds."
Between two worlds.
And I thought, wow.
And after that, you were reporting an astonishing number of really, really surprising episodes of psychicness, of clairvoyance, of when she was tuning in into troubles that you had. And she was actually saying it out loud. I remember you once said that you had some financial issues to sort out and you deliberately didn't want to tell her, not to burden her with it.
Yeah.
And then she actually, didn't she mention it?
Yes, I was in London,
mm-hmm,
dealing with lots of paperwork that I had to take to our family solicitor in Scotland, and I was traveling up the next day, and I was feeling very uncomfortable about it all.
Mm.
And of course, I mean, I hadn't discussed it with her. Anyway, I arrived in Scotland, got off the train, went straight into the care home, and she's sitting in the communal lounge and waves me over, and she says, "Margaret is busy with funds and finance. Margaret is a little confused."
That's unbelievable.
And I thought, I'm totally transparent. There's nothing I can hide from her. And it wasn't that she wasn't reprimanding me, but it showed me, I had wondered previously if she was just reading my mind, because she said lots of things in my book, I think.
I don't know. It's amazing how many examples you're bringing.
Yeah. In my book, I think I give 8 examples, her sort of reading, mind reading or telepathic or clairvoyant,
yes,
you know, examples, which she hadn't demonstrated in her life before. And I think what's happening is that, I'll give you a little tour of what I think is happening,
yes,
here. When people reach the stage of moderate to late stage Alzheimer's. I'm not talking about the beginning when they're maintaining control and they're, you know, it's a nightmare for everyone.
Yes.
I'm talking about when they just can't do that any longer.
Yes.
And they surrender. And their sense of self, they lose their sense of self. So their ego is no longer driving them. Also, the part of the brain, the left hemisphere, that processes small chunks of information sequentially, that part of the brain is no longer working effectively. So they lose a sense of linear time. And that means that past and future all roll into the present.
They are in the now, aren't they?
They
I think you even mentioned Eckhart Tolle, that they'd reach that state where meditators want to get when they have no time and no ego.
Yes, I that's my hypothesis.
Mm.
It's certainly opening a lot of eyes in the Alzheimer's world, because I don't think anybody had looked at it like this before. But just for people's information, when my mother started saying things right, you know, at the beginning, like, you love me, I'm a bad person, I started to record our conversations. She was also talking about deceased relatives visiting her, and she said, is it all right if I go next week? And I rather reluctantly said yes. I thought she was going to pass on very soon, and she was very frail. But actually, she lived for another 3.5 years. So I got more and more fascinated by what was going on between us. So I have actual recordings of our conversations for 3.5 years. And that time span gave me the opportunity to reflect on what was happening and come up with this hypothesis, which I really do believe is what's happening. Now, when people are in the now without an ego, they're in an altered state of consciousness.
Yes.
And my question is, what is happening in that altered state? How might we affect that? How might we accommodate that? I think these are really important questions, because I think I had been a soul seeker and a seeker of consciousness from my early 20s.
Yes.
And although I hadn't been diligent with my meditation, you know, continued throughout all these years, it certainly, that learning that I had in my early 20s, I belonged to an esoteric group that studied the work of Ouspensky.
Yes, right.
Mm-hmm. And we had weekly teachings from the Shukracharya of Northern India. You know, we're talking now about the time when and the Beatles were doing things like this too. But it was all very hush-hush. People didn't talk about it. But coming from a Presbyterian background, these new teachings just turned my whole understanding upside down.
Upside down, yes.
And I had a new way of, you know, thinking and being in the world as a result. So I brought that, my personal history, along with being a psychotherapist and a healer, I brought this to the situation with my mother when she had Alzheimer's. So I was able, when she was in these altered states, or even when she wasn't in the altered states, I was able to hold the space for her with you know, annoying, with awareness.
Mm.
And she recognizes, you know, when people are tuned in, they know when to trust somebody and when not to trust them. So she knew that I knew.
Yes, yes.
And so she trusted, she felt safe.
Yes.
And in that safe holding, I think she was able to traverse into other realms, other dimensions, and then she told me what she was experiencing, what She just told me as if we were having a normal conversation.
Absolutely. And it seemed like she had a serious learning experience in the other world as well, didn't she?
She did. Mm. It started when she said, I've had a big operation. And I thought, interesting.
Yes. What kind of operation?
And again, instead of dismissing these things as delusions or hallucinatory, I always asked her about them. So I said, oh, you know, where have you had the operation? She said, my mind.
Ah.
And I said, you know, who did this? She said, two women. They're very skillful. I feel much better.
And she did feel much better, didn't she? So there
yes.
was a change in her personality.
Yes. And I thought, you know, I thought this sounds to me like psychic surgery.
Mm.
Sounds to me like energies. Interacting with her energy
yes.
field and helping to heal the mind and mental part and emotional part of her field, which was enabling her to move forward.
It's and extremely interesting because we do read about those experiences that occur in between lives when people go have a regression, and then they remember times when they were in between physical lives.
Yes.
And they talk about finding helpers, healers, who, you know, help them to understand the mistakes of their lives, but also help them to correct them and to look forward to a more positive future and rebirth.
Yes, well, my mother had quite a number of experiences that
exactly. It seems like she had those even before she physically died.
Exactly. So I, you know, if we look at this, what's happening here? It seemed to me I like the analogy of a radio frequency.
Yes.
So it seemed to me that there was one frequency which
yes.
was the pain and discomfort of having Alzheimer's, you know, in her physical
reality. Mm-hmm.
That she also tuned into other frequencies. And
yes.
in the other frequencies, these may be the frequencies that we move to
mm-hmm.
or tune to when our physical body is no longer functioning,
yes.
when passed on. But she was able to move between, you know, this life and these experiences. And I think what's really significant is that because she had this was possible because she had Alzheimer's. It would never have happened for her without Alzheimer's because
yes.
she was anxious. But because she had Alzheimer's and the veil was very thin, you know, this was possible. And because I had some understanding of this, I was able to, you know, accommodate her and validate her. She also had what sounded like life reviews. She said, I'm remembering all the difficult times, all the people.
Mm-hmm.
And she had to think about three of these. And I, you know, we processed that.
Yes,
something
yes.
that I said to her that she found, I think, very helpful and is helpful to others and for ourselves is to say, we all do the best we can at the time. If we could have done something different, we would have done. And it's easy in retrospect to look back.
Mm.
Well, how did I do that? Or, but actually, at the time, it was the very best we could do. And my mother was very happy with that.
Yeah, it is so therapeutic, isn't it?
It sounds so simplistic.
But it's not. It's not. No.
It actually
yes,
worked
yes.
for her. She also had out-of-body experiences.
Mm-hmm.
I've had an out-of-body, it's a spontaneous out-of-body experience, which wasn't quite as what she described. She said something like, I have, my head's not attached to my body.
Yeah, right, yes. yes.
And I thought, that sounds to me, it's either a very disassociated state
mm.
or she's having an out-of-body experience.
Yes.
Well, wasn't disassociated, far from it. So I put that down to
yes.
an out-of-body experience.
Yes.
And she also had astral travel or out-of-body travel.
Yes.
And I asked her, you know, where she wanted to go.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, I like to float across the oceans. Anyway, sometimes when she told me things like that, we would have a little chat and I would talk to her about, so I talked to her about astral travel, you know, as a matter of fact.
Yes, yes.
And the following day, she said to me, my brother, who was deceased, asked me to visit him, and I did. And I thought, brilliant.
It is very, very brilliant. And how fortunate that you were open to this.
Well, to me, it was everything that I wanted and needed.
Yes.
So, and I was being given such a gift.
I mean, just listening to what you're saying must be so humbling for so many people who believe so much in the body and in the health of the physical body and the brain. And they think if that starts to shut down, then we can forget it. And actually, this just shows that that's when something incredible is beginning to happen.
It seems to me, while our cognition is intact, our chattering monkey mind
is so much more active, isn't it?
And that doesn't leave space for, you know, other things to happen. And in Alzheimer's, as the disease progresses and the brain slows down, the mind and the thought process can actually expand. And this leads into theories of, you know, morphic resonance,
yes, yes.
You know, Rupert Sheldrake, yes. Of non-locality of mind, the extended mind. And I am in absolutely no doubt that consciousness is not located in the brain.
No, it's not. I totally agree with your view. And I think the radio analogy is very good here as well.
Yes.
That our brain is like the radio receiver, the actual little object.
Yes.
But you can destroy a radio and the programs are still out there and you can get another radio and you can start listening to the programs again.
Yes.
So you can destroy the physical brain, but you will have a new body and a new brain.
Yes.
And you can tune into the same things and you can continue the programs with a new receiver.
Yes.
Obviously, the brain plays a very important role.
Yes.
But to me, it's a receiving thing.
Yes.
It's a receiving and a processor. But we don't need the brain for the mental functions to be intact.
No. And I was interested in something she said.
Mm-hmm.
She said, the thought process is amazing. Now, this is, you know, in the esoteric wisdom traditions, there's a lot is said about thought, and but thought continues. And my mother said something like, I have no brain cells left, but I think a lot. And again, I think this is a wake-up call for us.
Oh, it so much is.
Aware that people with Alzheimer's, some of them might be in some kind of locked-in syndrome, that, you know, they've lost, their brain isn't functioning properly, so they've lost their ability to speak, they've lost their ability to process information sequentially, they can't remember, but that doesn't mean that nothing's happening.
Absolutely not.
Mm.
I read a very interesting phenomenon and then I experienced it myself. And that was when people sometimes meditate or even dream or have an OB. And then they gain information from the other world that is very profound. And they have that sense that it is something important. But when they want to remember it, they actually cannot, because the brain is not evolved enough to process that level of information. It's a little bit like you're trying to put a very sophisticated software on an old computer. You understand what I'm trying to say? That it's too old and too simple. You know, we have our brain that evolved from the monkey, and that is a tool that we, you know, evolved to open the coconut or whatever, you know, make simple tools. And it's good for a certain thing and to a certain level, but then we can, as I said, I experienced a person and I heard it from other people, that you can in an altered state of consciousness receive information that is, you feel it's profound, and in that moment you got it.
Yeah.
But then you come back into your physical brain and you have this sense of frustration where you just like can't put it into words, you can't formulate a theory, you can't share it with anyone, because the brain is not sufficient.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting.
It must be the same kind of thing that your mother was probably, and the gap was probably even bigger, because she must have accessed all that otherworldly information that is normally just accessible in the in-between life state.
Yeah.
But then she had that brain that just got even worse than the average brain. And how big the gap must have been.
Yes, I mean, we were very fortunate that she retained her faculty of speech and was able
Yes.
I actually think, I think there was a master plan here.
Yes.
But because she said, she had been a teacher.
Mm.
Right at the beginning, when she was talking about it's difficult working between two worlds, and she said, we're learning we are immortal. You must tell others.
Ah.
And so, you know, it's my job. I've been assigned
yes.
a job to make this information available to others. And I think it's all the more believable because it came through somebody who had Alzheimer's, who couldn't remember.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this wasn't learned information.
Yeah, she couldn't have read it in a book because she would have forgotten.
You know, provincial Scotland, she hadn't been exposed to these things.
Yeah, that is amazing.
So I think that, you know, also as I said, you know, I was able to bring some, a certain amount of knowledge and understanding to the situation that enabled this to move forward. And as a writer, I was able to formulate it in a way that makes it readable mm-hmm. and understandable to others. Mm. As in addition to, you know, 2/3 of the book is our dialogue. Along with the dialogue, I comment on what my understanding of what is happening. And I think this is important for others to know. It certainly changed my belief yes. about death.
Yes.
And you know, when you no longer fear death, you can live more fully.
Absolutely.
And that's my message to people when I'm, you know, giving talks.
Yes.
I want people to lose their fear of death and be able to live more fully.
And it's probably fair to say that you no longer have a belief, but you have a knowledge. Would that be fair to say? Yes. There is a big quality difference, isn't there?
There is.
Between a simple religious belief that is a kind of hope and the knowledge that is rooted in experience.
Yes. And I had, you know, 3.5 years of this with my mother, and then there was writing it. So I was revisiting it and writing it in the first person in present time. So that really embedded it.
Mm.
And it was a process that I needed, I think, because prior to that, although I was a, in quotes, believer, most of the time it was fine. And every now and then I had had just a little nagging doubt.
Oh, right. Yes.
And then I'd come back to center and it would be fine.
Of course.
I don't have that nagging doubt
anymore. Yes. And it might be actually a call of the times. Because I remember I had an out-of-body experience, the first one long, long time ago. And there was a spiritual guide there. And he said to me that the reason why you're experiencing this is because this is how it feels to die. And we want you to know that this is how it feels to die. And this is why I'm telling it to you now, because he said, so that you can tell others. It was the same message. Tell others. We want, and that's what I'm saying, it might be a historic thing that we might be at times where it is becoming a call of the time to actually inform people, to tell them that it's no longer a belief. We are getting knowledge. We are getting actual experiential knowledge about the fact that life continues.
Yeah.
And we have to be prepared for that, and we have to take the responsibility that comes with that.
Yes.
So that strikes me as extremely important.
Yeah.
And very uplifting as well.
I mean, for me, the the key to unlocking this was love.
Yeah. Oh.
Is love.
What would you say is love? I know it's impossible to define, and I'm not asking for a definition because I believe that's impossible, but how could you tune into love more? Or what made you, because throughout the pages of your book, you can feel that there was so much love and you were generating so much love. What made it possible for you?
I think being open.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It was my mother's vulnerability.
Okay.
That evoked compassion and love in me.
Right.
Then through this process that I have described of me, sort of me experiencing compassion and love, her sensing, empathizing, feeding it back to me.
It was
me,
a feedback loop, wasn't it?
Mm. We got into a symbiotic loving relationship. And because she was learning emotionally, despite her Alzheimer's, yes. That just got stronger and stronger. And I asked her once, describe love.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, it's like floating. And I thought, she really does know.
Yes.
Because that's such a lovely description.
Yes.
Said it's like floating. And then she said, you must tell Russell. That was her husband.
Right.
So after my mother had passed on, my father lived for another 3 years, and I went through a similar journey with him. It wasn't, he didn't have Alzheimer's, and his transformation happened in a much shorter period of time at the end of his life, but nevertheless, it happened with him too.
As well, yeah.
He's a man, Scottish, conservative, no-nonsense, Church of Scotland,
right.
but in the last, probably the last 6 months of his life, he had out of body experiences. He went to other realms, and he knew that I was the only person he could tell.
Right.
I remember arriving in the care home one day because he was in a care home too. And he was frantically waving me over. And he just couldn't wait to tell me. And so I sat down. He said, I know you'll believe me, but nobody else will. And then he told me about this experience that he had. And I knew that he had met people on the other side.
Yes.
I knew that he was probably quite close to the end of his life here. You know, in his physical body. And, but he knew that I would, you know, he trusted me. He knew that I would believe him.
Yeah.
That was so reassuring for him. I think, the more that people can take this on board and be open and say, well, it's even if people don't believe, it's real for the person. We should validate what they're experiencing as real for them and keep an open mind.
Absolutely.
Maybe there's something there for us to discover too.
Yes, that is a great approach. And Maggie, because you were so open, what would you say surprised you the most?
I'd say everything. I think I've probably spoken. All the things I've spoken about were total surprises because I had no knowledge about Alzheimer's when my mother was diagnosed. I was, commuting between London and Scotland. It was, I was trying to maintain my own health practice here in London and teaching. It was a very, very busy time for me. And there wasn't a lot of information available online like there is now. Yeah. So I didn't have a lot of time to research. But I was surprised about the other world.
Yeah.
That was, I did not expect, I was surprised and delighted. So everything to do with my mother's other world experiences. She talked about television is marvelous. I can go there and ask all my questions. Now, I think she was probably, when I'm speaking to psychics, they describe, you know, seeing and processing information as if it's a television set.
Yes.
So I think my mother was receiving information through her third eye.
Yes.
And yes. And you know, her out of body experiences, her numerous extrasensory, you know, perception of me, her reference to past lives, I don't know which century, her contact with deceased relatives, that towards the more trail she got, the more lucid she became at times. It was as if she saw everything and was able to sum that up in just a few words that were absolutely spot on. And this, by the way, is not exclusive to people with Alzheimer's. Peter Fenwick, I don't know if you know his work. He's an expert on near-death experience. He's done a lot of research into end-of-life experiences. Yes. Peter's research has shown that many people at the end of life have the sort of experiences that my mother had. They have out-of-body experiences. They have contact with deceased relatives. They have what's called terminal lucidity. So my mother's experiences were not exclusive. They are out there if people are open to them.
Yes. And how very important it is that everybody has a witness that they can talk to, so
yes.
that they can learn to take these things seriously and trust them.
Yes. I mean, I belong to a group called Spiritual Companions, which is a UK-based group.
Oh, beautiful.
If people want to find out more, they can just Google it and they'll find it online.
So it's Spiritual...
Spiritual Companions.
Spiritual Companions.
Was set up by William Bloom.
Mm.
And I think it's a very, very good organization because people are given a very thorough training.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just that you go online and sign up and you're a registered member. Even although, you know, I'm a psychotherapist and a healer and I've been doing this for over 30 years. When I wanted to join, I had to attend a group for a year.
Right.
Rather than going through the full training, which is a few years.
Okay.
You know, to ensure that I wasn't projecting my, beliefs onto anybody and acting responsibly. And there are very clear guidelines for people to follow. And the guidelines may actually be online, and if they are, it's well worth looking at them. Because there is a responsibility. There are ethics here.
Yes.
There's a responsibility to behave in ways that are are going to enhance the person's experience and not in any way limit it.
Yes. Or as you say, mold it into somebody else's beliefs, for example.
Yes,
And if you're talking about other people, so you had this really, really enlightening experience, and you even said that you have the mission to talk about it to others. So how would you sum up, what are the main key things that you believe people need to know in order to find a positive way forward?
I think to just be aware the person is not the disease. They're still that person. Their essence remains.
Yes.
To have an open heart.
Yes.
Let love. Love is there.
Right.
It's present and be open to that. Yes. An open mind. And to seek meaningful communication.
Mm.
Yeah,
that's interesting. Maybe you can even generalize that. Would you agree that it's not just that the illness is not the person, but even if you generalize it in all sorts of life situations, that whatever problem, whatever illness, whatever challenge someone is in, that is not the person.
Yes.
I think that is such an empowering thought, isn't it? That even if you see a homeless person, that is not the person. That is that person in that present situation, in that whole cycle of life and death.
Yes.
But you can never identify the soul with that situation. And I think that would enable all of us, if we thought like that, it would enable all of us to be much more democratic.
Yeah.
In a spiritual sense, if that makes sense, you know.
Coming back to the open heart, I believe love is the gateway between the physical realm and the non-physical.
Right, yeah.
And that's, you know, in terms of chakras,
yes.
It's heart chakra. So it's the midway, you know, the middle chakra between the lower chakras and the higher chakras.
The heart.
Yes. Another important thing is to be totally present.
Mm.
And my mother taught me to be totally present. As her brain slowed down, she stared at me often. Mm.
And there was no escape into the past or the future.
There was no escape.
Exactly.
You know, I had done exercises like this in groups.
Yes.
But we're not talking about a group exercise here. We're talking about someone who sat very firmly and still and looked into my eyes. And I decided to try and be with that. And that was such a learning for me. Because sometimes, you know, I'd be busy, I'd be buzzing, I'd be wanting to just escape. And she'd say, "What's stopping you?" So she taught me to be present.
She was very much down to the point, wasn't she?
She was. Direct, but then people with Alzheimer's are, because the filters that we employ,
they don't work anymore.
That come between our thought and what we say. If we said everything we thought, we would be in trouble.
Yes.
But you know, people with Alzheimer's don't have that filter, so they just say what they are thinking straight out. Another thing I think is to be really flexible, be curious. Mm. Join them in their world and to, as I said before, to validate their experience as being real for them.
Yes.
But in the other world, it's wonderful. She didn't tell me anything about the other world that was bad or difficult. I mean, it was just really wonderful. And to keep communicating, to be aware that if we're talking about Alzheimer's, and I think people generally at the end of life, it can be a bit up and down. Mm. That, you know, people get infections, they have a bad few days and seem a bit out of it. Not to discount everything, and just to keep trying to communicate, and you probably find that in a day or two, things are better again. And can continue, and to appreciate what they are giving us.
Yeah.
You know, I, my mother was so delighted when I validated her and thanked her for what she was telling me. It was as if nobody had ever done that in her life before.
That is something, isn't it?
Yeah. So appreciation, love, and appreciation are very important. Mm. And I'm focusing on Alzheimer's, because Alzheimer's is a protracted end of life experience. Mm. And that has given me time to take an overview and be aware that dying can be a very intelligent process.
Yes.
And, you know, my mother described various stages and phases that she went through. She talked about programs, about supervision and tests. And she had at least three of these. And I wonder if each of these she could have passed on at the end, but because there was more to do here, she stayed on. That's my personal belief about what was happening.
Because again, they ring true to me as very often happening in the inter-life period as well. You know, that you do have those programs, or some people call it courses, and then you do have learning happening. You do have teachers, you do have to pass tests.
Yes, and she talked about books.
About, yes.
Yeah. I thought, are these the Akashic records?
Yes. Yeah.
But you know, I validated her books, and she said I've read four, and I've got four more, or something like that. So this is a time to heal relationships. Mm. Not only was the relationship between my mother and me healed, the whole family healed. It was absolutely miraculous because, you know, given her mental instability, we were quite a dysfunctional family. I hesitate to say that, but that was. And in the end, through her Alzheimer's, everybody was healed in the most miraculous way. So it's never too late to heal the past.
Yes. Was that the greatest gift, you would say? Or what were the greatest gifts?
Oh, now you're
coming back to the beginning, you know, we said this phrase, the gift of Alzheimer's.
Yes.
And you immediately elaborated on that, how, you know, it's a controversial thing to say because, as you said, it wasn't a joyride.
No, no. Well, I say, who on earth would say Alzheimer's was a gift? On this earth, it wasn't a gift. But in a dimension, outside the physical dimension, it was. Yeah. And in that other dimension, there's universal love. There's no fear of death, no pain, no suffering. And that's what she told me. So these are gifts for us all to know that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, I'm immensely grateful to have had this conversation with you.
Thank you.
It was absolutely beautiful. And I got goose pimples all the time while you were talking. So thank you very, very much for being here today.
Well, thank you, Victoria. I've really enjoyed speaking to you.
Me too, me too. And what I will do is I will put all your websites and, link to the book on the Zenith website. So I'm sure that the people who are listening to you, they will check out your book as I did. And it is a phenomenal read. Very, very going the same what we were talking about now, but going deeper. And I wish you all the best to go on and spreading this really, really important message.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.